From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Coming up on the show today, a New York Times reporter chronicles the end of the line for a rural Wisconsin elementary school.
There was, potlucks and end-of-the-year celebrations planned, but everyone knew that this was going to be the last year for this school, and there was definitely a lot of melancholy.
Later, when we talk about making cities bike or pedestrian friendly, are some people being left behind?
If we think about, a grandma maybe with a child walking around and biking around, what do they need to be able to walk and bike? And if we design it for that 8 to 80 age range, everyone will enjoy it.
Plus, film contributor Ryan Jay discusses the latest in the Jurassic World franchise, and we'll have this week's edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Good afternoon. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Arena, Wisconsin, population 834, does not find itself in the national spotlight very often. For most of the people who live there, they would probably have preferred not to have been in the New York Times last week.
The piece was on the closing of the village's lone elementary school and how it relates to the broader waning of rural communities like Arena. Julie Bosman is a national correspondent for the New York Times, and we reached her on the line from Chicago. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much.
What turned you on to the story in the first place?
So I cover the Midwest for the New York Times, and I happened to notice that there were a lot of stories in Wisconsin, and I had been personally hearing about the challenges that so many school districts were facing, and school districts primarily in rural communities. And this seemed to be a problem that was being repeated over and over. What do you do when you don't have the population that you used to in a lot of these rural towns? And what happens when the enrollment of these little schools keeps going down and down and down? And when I started making phone calls and talking to superintendents in these areas, they all said the same thing, which is, these communities are really aging. They're not necessarily losing a ton of population, but the population is getting a lot older, and there aren't as many farms out here anymore. There aren't as many farm families anymore, and people aren't having as many children. So when all of those things add up, you get elementary schools that have 40 kids in them, and that becomes a real problem for budgets and a real problem for the future of these communities.
Well, I get the sense that a lot of these communities, these are places that years ago may have had their own high school, but there's been consolidation at the high school level for a long time.
Absolutely. And this consolidation has really happened in waves for decades and decades. I mean, when you look at the entire country, the total number of schools in America has gone way down, and it's been going down for probably 130 years. But the areas that have been hit the hardest are rural areas. And there was a big wave of consolidation in the 1950s and 1960s when a lot of little one-room schoolhouses were closed down. And those were the schoolhouses that were really out in the middle of the country. And then you had the smaller towns, like the one that I focused on, Arena, which is outside of Spring Green, that were left with these with their own schools. And in many cases, this was also when the high school was closed. So when I went to the Spring Green area and talked to people in the village of Lone Rock and the village of Arena, there were people who were still really, really angry over the fact that the high school in Arena had closed in, around 1960. So people have very long memories about school closures.
Well, and at some level, this is about more than just a school.
It is. And I think that it goes way beyond the school itself, because some of the people who are most upset over these closures don't have children in the school, might not even have grandchildren in the school, but have lived in the community for a really long time and understand how important a school can be to a community, they can really be the bedrock of the area, not just a school, but, you know, a visible presence, a place where the community can gather, sort of an informal town hall of sorts. And I think that when the schools go away, people know that it's going to mean a lot more than there's not going to be an elementary school here. It's going to stand empty. And that's upsetting on its own. What's going to go into this school that was built in the 1950s that hasn't been modernized, that doesn't really have a ton of other good uses? And I think people know that it's going to affect everybody's property values and the future of the town.
How long had the situation in Arena been building towards this particular denouement?
I would say probably more than a decade. When I spoke to the superintendent there, he said that you know, the population in the area for the school district, which includes Arena, Spring Green, Lone Rock, and another small village called Plain, he said that it had been at least 15 years since the population had been going down. And there was really not that much that they could do about that. The farming jobs, of course, had disappeared or at least decreased in large numbers, and there weren't as many manufacturing jobs either. So they looked at the numbers, and they commissioned a study from UW, and it looked like the problem was only going to get worse in the future.
They tried some things to try to head this off, right?
They did, and you know, the school officials there took no pleasure in closing the Arena School and the Lone Rock School, which closed at the end of the last school year, a year ago. They did a referendum in 2016 asking voters for more money. They said, look, if we're going to keep these schools open, we have to have more money. And I think they asked for $9.3 million, which would be spent over the next several years. And the voters said no. And of course, this was incredibly upsetting to people in these towns where they lost their schools. But a lot of people just had a very, you know, clear-eyed look at what was going on and said, there's no future for these schools, and we're just throwing money at them, and we need to face the facts.
You mentioned the resentment that's still out there from closing the high school in 1960. I would imagine that there's plenty of resentment over this vote just, you know, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I think that there were a lot of families that, you know, were divided over this, a lot of friendships. I spoke with people who said, you know, I just couldn't even bring it up anymore because it was so upsetting to hear the things that people were saying, you know, and it kind of came down to like village versus village. You know, you have this school district that covers about 300 square miles. And of course, this is, you know, one of the most beautiful places in Wisconsin. Taliesin is there, you know, the bluffs, and it's incredibly picturesque. And you can see why people would want to live there. But it became this really angry fight from village to village, where Spring Green people tended to vote against the referendum, saying, no, we don't want to give any more money. And the smaller villages said, no, we actually do, and we support this. So it became a matter of geography within the district that determined how people felt about this particular issue.
Right. It sounds a little like, you know, maybe a microcosm of the way Wisconsin works as a whole, you know, sort of Milwaukee being the big city and the rural-urban divide, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at population patterns in Wisconsin and in plenty of other states, you know, the numbers are right there. Like the population shifts over the last couple of decades, people are moving out of rural areas and into cities and into suburban areas. And that was one of the things that made this story so stark, that when you look at the people of Arena, you know, they're not very far from Madison. A lot of people who, you know, live in the Spring Green area work in Madison and just have kind of a long commute to work, but it's not that far away. But the school districts in, say, Middleton, Wisconsin, outside of Madison, like, they're beautiful. The schools are huge. They have much more modern facilities. The kids have more programming. It's like night and day.
How much time did you spend in Arena for this story?
I worked on the story over a period of months, a lot of phone reporting. I visited there in person a few months ago and spent some time at the school and spent some time talking to families there. And it was just one of the stories that really interested me personally, and I was happy that I had a good amount of time to plug away on it.
Yeah, I mean, can you paint a picture of what the waning days of the elementary schools last year felt like? And I mean, you were there not right at the end of the school year, but close, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of mournful. I think that, you know, the teachers and the parents in Arena did everything they could to try to make it smooth for the kids. And if anyone tended to be okay with it, it was probably the kids who went there. I mean, I think kids tend to kind of roll with the situation, and they were more okay with going to the Spring Green school next fall than their parents were. But in many ways, when you went to the Arena school, it looked like a school that was winding down for the end of the school year, like all schools do. You know, the teachers had started kind of taking their classrooms down, taking the posters down. Things were getting packed up. There was, you know, potlucks and end-of-the-year celebrations planned. But everyone knew that this was going to be the last year for this school. And there was definitely a lot of melancholy as people, you know, talked about that and thought about what the bigger implications were for their community.
I gather you grew up in Wisconsin. I don't know how large a school district you called home when you were young, but I wonder if you know, you had any kinds of elementary school flashbacks while you were doing this.
So I grew up in Kenosha, and I went to the a big public high school in Kenosha, Mary D. Bradford on the north side of Kenosha. But I had a very different experience from my elementary school, which was, you know, a small parochial school where I think if we had 15 kids in a classroom, that was considered large. And actually, every time that I go home to visit family, I often, my route takes me past that old school, which has now been consolidated with a different school. So you can see this. It's not just a public school problem. It's something that is happening in for private schools too. And I think it takes a lot of adjustment to people, and it sends a message about you know, how their communities are changing. And I think it's a very tough thing for a lot of people.
Well, Julie Bossman, it's a really affecting story. Job well done, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Julie Bossman is a native of the Kenosha area. She's a national correspondent for the New York Times based in Chicago. You can find a link to her feature on the closing of the elementary school in Arena, Wisconsin at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then we explore whether the way urban planning is done today discourages women from becoming more avid bicyclists. Lake Effect Weekend continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. A couple of weeks ago, leaders in the movement to build bike trail networks around the country met in Milwaukee to talk about the effort and share what they've learned. The planned Route of the Badger in this area would eventually encompass some 500 miles of trails. While cyclists already use several hundred miles of bike trails in the region, many do most of their riding on roads, both with and without dedicated bike lanes.
But an article recently in the Guardian newspaper made the point that much of the existing bicycle infrastructure, save for bike trails, in many countries was built with only the hardiest of riders in mind, and leaves many people, especially women and children, with few viable options. We wondered if that was a familiar refrain in this area, and so Lake Effect's Susan Benz sat down near the Oakleaf Trail with Wisconsin Bike Federation Deputy Director Jessica Weinberg and asked her.
The article is really interesting. I do think we're in a new era of bicycle facilities design. The first things we were able to do were for the strong and fearless bicyclists, so that was really a stripe of paint on a roadway and having that be the physical space that you get to ride in. And it helped. It taught drivers bicycles are legal vehicles. They should be on the road. And we have seen big increases in biking across the country and in Milwaukee. So that worked for the strong and fearless cyclists, which I am one. But if we want to get a much bigger slice of the population biking, then we need more advanced facilities with actual physical separation between.
This writer was talking about, you know, is in Great Britain, for one, in the United
right.
Kingdom. One of the issues that she is citing in Manchester, I think in particular, is that city planners tend to be male, that the people on councils tend to be male, and they're determining budgets and where to allocate those monies. How does that compare to here?
Yeah, that concept was really interesting. You know, do we have these facilities because men are planning them, so of course men are more comfortable with them? I'm still thinking about that and if that's part of what we're dealing with here. Yes, at traffic engineering, traffic design is a male-dominated field. I think it's less and less so all the time. So that might be happening. And the Milwaukee Common Council didn't have a single woman on it for, I think, 5 years. So, you know, we do have these issues with men making more of the decisions. I'd like to think men can make good decisions for all of us. There's actually a cool movement, too, to really try to think about children in city planning. And they're for sure left out of the official process. There are no children in common councils or designing anything. And it's really interesting to think about how inhospitable our cities are to children. And so that's like another proxy you can think about, and that definitely when people aren't involved in the process, their needs aren't going to get met.
What's your sense of female riders versus male in your world, in this world?
Yeah, in 2009, women did account for 24% of bicycle trips in the U.S. That's the latest data we have that's gender specific. You know, I think that's an imbalance that we want to change and improve, and we can. And I think if you look at trails or other separated bikeway facilities, the ridership would be more balanced. But when you look overall, there is that skew. And we see it again and again in talking to people or in surveys that women want more safe spaces to ride. And we do have a reckless driving problem in Milwaukee. Walking and biking are safe, but it doesn't always feel like it is, and it could be safer. Women also do the bulk of trips, taking their kids to and from school or daycare. And I know as soon as I had my son, I felt that my own life was a little bit more important and I wasn't willing to take risks, knowing I was responsible for him. And then, of course, when he was with me on the bike, I did want a comfortable experience, not being nervous that anything was going to happen. So I think if we can, we have space in Milwaukee, we have very wide streets, we have wide right-of-ways, we have abandoned railroad corridors, we can make more separated facilities, and I think that is our next push, and it'll have such big public health benefits, economic benefits. Everyone wants these facilities. One of the best ways to think about urban design in general, not just for biking, is that you want to design for the least able or the, you know, the most disadvantaged. And if we think about, you know, I don't know, a grandma maybe with a child walking around and biking around, what do they need to be able to walk and bike? And if we design it for that 8 to 80 age range, everyone will enjoy it.
Something that I hear anecdotally, and I ride my bike when I can, I commute when I can. I've heard from a number of vehicle drivers who intensely dislike bikers in general. Am I overstating?
No, I mean, I think there are still some drivers who don't like people biking, which I really don't understand, because everyone who's biking is giving more space to those who continue to drive. They're making traffic better for people who drive. Yeah, I don't know where there's still this, you know, get out of my way kind of feeling sometimes. I do think it's way better in Milwaukee over the last...
No, are you saying get out of my way on both sides, both on the biker side and the vehicle driver side?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's the people who are driving cars who are much more like, get out of my way, because as a bicyclist, you can't force anything. I've been thinking about this recently, that cars are basically bullies, whether people intend that to be or not, So I think a lot of drivers actually are bullies when they drive, even if they don't really realize it. You can see people at a crosswalk that's marked. It might even have a sign saying yield to pedestrians in the crosswalk. I saw this on Brady Street yesterday. And unless the pedestrian is completely forcing their way into the crosswalk, most drivers don't want to stop. And I think the drivers are kind of like, oh, you don't really need me to stop. You're going to be okay with this. And they're just bullying their way to getting more space.
You know, I feel like that's a complicated issue because I I see cyclists as well who aren't following the rules of the road.
Right. No, there's been some studies that really show that humans break traffic laws at the same rate across modes. The issue is when you break a law in a car, it's a 4,000-pound vehicle that can kill people easily. When you break a law and you're walking or biking, you will only hurt yourself. And I think as a society, we have to say that that is very, very different. When a drunk driver drives, we're so concerned because they're endangering everyone around them. We have to say that innocent people deserve to be protected and that you have a responsibility when your actions could hurt other people, and it's your job to keep everyone around you safe. And that's really the traffic change that we need to see, is that we all take a responsibility for everybody around us and think about their safety. And, you know, for the drivers that we were talking about before, people who drive who don't like bicyclists on the roadways, they should be the biggest supporters of separated bikeways. If you give bicyclists great paths, great protected bikeways, make it very clear who should be where, then the person driving won't have to share their lane as much with someone biking.
So again, back to this Guardian opinion piece, the number one reason for not biking, for commuting, they think of it as being dangerous. They feel more vulnerable, reluctant to own the lane. Now, you said you're a fearless rider. Is that what you see as part of the complexity of this? Maybe it's not a women thing, that some bikers are not owning the lane?
Yeah, I think it's very true that the more knowledgeable and confident you are about the laws and how you should safely be operating as a bicyclist, the safer you make yourself. And part of that is being comfortable taking the lane. That's one of the things we really focused on our Savvy City Cycling classes. This spring, we taught a few classes specifically to a women's audience, to some women's bike clubs in the area, because there's something nice about having a group of women come together and talk about what are the issues on the street, and we can talk about catcalling, and does that really happen? Should you be nervous about it, or is it not a big deal? But one of the big things we teach in our classes, whether it's a female audience or a mixed group, is that you should take the lane when you need to, and you have that right. And when there isn't space to share, you can take the lane. And doing that does make you safe. It makes sure that people passing you go into another lane. And it's hard to know that you can do that unless you either know the law or have ridden for a really long time, or you take one of our classes. So if you take a Savvy City Cycling class, you can learn those details. And I hear again and again from people who take our classes that by learning that they can take the lane and they don't have to hug the curb, they do feel safer and more comfortable, and cars actually give them more space. So there is a confidence thing that helps the drivers around you treat you better, and that crosses genders. It's really for everybody. One thing that's kind of relevant to this is that the Path to Platinum group with Professor Schneider at UWM did a survey really asking people about their preferences for biking and what are the issues and why aren't they biking, and he did a gender analysis. So he found that although both men and women thought that unsafe intersections, bad drivers, automobile traffic were big issues that were barriers to biking for them and for other people, women identified these in much greater numbers. So, you know, those are major, major concerns for women. And personal safety was slightly higher for women as well. But more than 60% of women said unsafe intersections, bad drivers, and automobile traffic were concerns. And men were more around the 50% range. So, you know, it's not a huge difference, but it's something. And it really ties in well with where the city of Milwaukee and the communities around want to go with biking, that they want to put in more trails, they want to put in more separated bikeways.
Does this piece, back to The Guardian, does it give you some food for thought in particular?
The Guardian piece definitely gives me food for thought, especially about thinking about who's not at the table when planning decisions are getting made. In this instance, there's a focus on gender, but there's lots of other things that matter. Is it children? Is it race? Is it immigration status? You know, and how do we know what these other people's needs are? So the Bike Fed's been working with the city of Milwaukee on a complete streets policy, and we've been working with 5 community groups that do in-depth outreach and have deep connections with these various communities, and we're working to help connect their voices and their concerns to this policy that's really setting up how are we going to make our streets look in the future, and safety is going to be at the center. And it turns out that immigrants on the near south side and longtime residents on the northwest side both want their streets safer. They want slower speeds, and they want the ability to walk and bike for them and their families. And the city's been really responsive and wants to hear more of that feedback. And they admit that when they just have a meeting and say, hey, who wants to come and talk about, you know, this 35th Street getting reconstructed? It might only be certain people that show up, and they're very open to thinking about new designs that bring a wider perspective.
Jessica Weinberg is deputy director of the Wisconsin Bike Federation. She spoke with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz. You'll find a link to the Guardian article that spurred their conversation at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then film contributor Ryan Jay joins us to talk about the latest installment in the Jurassic World franchise. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's been 25 years since movie audiences first saw awe-inspiring dinosaurs come to life in Steven Spielberg's classic film, Jurassic Park. Yet 5 films later, and possibly counting, studios are still making movies about the inevitable bad situations that will happen when large, once extinct, dangerous creatures are brought back to life.
Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom is the latest installment in the franchise and is out in theaters now. Taking place 4 years after the Jurassic World theme park closed, heroes and anti-heroes alike return to save the dinosaurs from extinction after a once dormant volcano threatens all life forms on the island.
However, as with all movies involving dinosaurs and humans, things get complicated. To help sort out whether Jurassic World's story holds up or is just another summer film to bring in audiences, we turn to film contributor Ryan Jay. Ryan, welcome back to Lake Effect.
I'm glad to be back.
Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom is the 5th entry of the Jurassic franchise, but I think it's the first one that tried to be a bit more than a ride in a dinosaur amusement park. What was your thoughts on it?
You're so right. I also think it's the first one since the first installment, Jurassic Park, directed by Steven Spielberg, that really honors that one in terms of tone and theme and emotion.
Also some good scenes that paid homage directly to some of the shot for shot.
Absolutely.
Like, here's the opening first dinosaur encounter, or even as simple as, like, here's a goat to lure a T-Rex.
Oh, it's so true. It's so true. And just the suspense and the action, and I think the way that you're feeling. I mean, it's almost like those manipulative Disney short films, the Disney Pixar short films, where in 2 minutes they can make you cry. There are those moments in this film, and there are also just great action and effects scenes.
Yeah, I think this can be classified more of an action adventure thriller compared to the smorgasbord that the last Jurassic Park
and almost
was.
Like lighthearted horror. You know what I mean? Like, it was kind of scary at moments.
Yeah, I was nervous the whole time.
And I'll never forget the very first time I saw the first Jurassic Park in the theater, because I was like, I love dinosaurs. You know, you studied them as a kid. You saw them, you know, the display at the Milwaukee Public Museum. And then you go and see Jurassic Park and you're like terrified. And you're like, what is happening? I thought I was seeing, like, you know, a cute dinosaur movie. And wow. So this movie, too, certainly had, whether they're, you know, almost like haunted house moments or just dinosaurs that look like they're in a museum coming to life, coming after you. It's like they're all in there.
One thing that was different from some of the past installments is that the dinosaurs themselves are not as prominent throughout in this film. But I think that the setting of, you know, I don't think it's a spoiler to say the setting is at this big estate in Northern California.
Right, if anyone's seen the trailer.
Yeah, the dinosaurs have to leave the island that they originally housed on.
Because of a volcano. And the volcano, by the way, is like another monster in the movie.
Yes.
Very cool.
Absolutely. So, you know, having this contained set with the dinosaurs and the humans all in one smaller place, I think that lent a greater feel of risk and uncertainty compared to, say, the last film where everyone's running rampant on an island in an amusement park. You know, this was, had a bigger sense of consequence.
Right. I think it's the difference between just rustling, you know, bushes and long grass where you're thinking something's there on an island versus, you're right, like, can they break free of these cages? Or you're in a room that's filled with dinosaur relics and there's a shadow. Wait a minute. Is that from the relic or is there a dinosaur in here?
Yes. Now, one thing I have to admit, as much as I enjoy these movies and, you know, have that same kid wonder of, like, dinosaurs, this is awesome, you know.
Yeah.
I still get incredibly annoyed because they create the problems for themselves every time. And I'm wondering how many times can they recycle the plot of bringing back dinosaurs and something goes wrong. That's essentially the baseline for every film.
Right. And I, you know, I see what you're saying. And I think that there is a bit of tiredness to that, but I think that the stories keep coming back well, and the casting is so good. I mean, I love Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard, and their chemistry is so fun and so magnetic in these films that I almost want to see them do more together, and even other genres I'd take with them as a team. But the one theme that will always play, no matter how many times it repeats itself, is the corruption of greed in the human spirit. And so that is the one thing that kind of is a common thread throughout all of the Jurassic movies. We see that there is the spiraling out of control of human greed for money, for power, for weaponizing these dinosaurs. And, you know, it's kind of like, as long as they can repackage it in the right way. And I think there are enough new elements in this film in particular, without, you know, without dropping some spoilers here, that were really fantastic and smart, that I kind of forgive it, that it's kind of like, oh, we smuggled in some DNA and we're going to recycle it once again and it's going to go wrong for, you know, a
blockbuster. We're going to leave this cage open.
Exactly.
Well, and I do think that this struck a more serious tone because it goes into the scientific and moral implications of creating something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do you have an obligation to keep it alive, or do they have the same rights as other animals because they are essentially human made?
Right. And they do absolutely play up on that emotional factor. There is especially a moment where you can't help, no matter where you would fall on that side of the argument, where you can't help but feel emotional and connected to these, you know, in reality today, mythical creatures.
You touched upon Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard. Do you feel that Chris's performance was not necessarily subdued, but it took a different tone this time around?
Yeah, I mean, I think he had less to do. You know, he's still the hero for sure, but he had a smaller role. I think this was more of an ensemble piece, whereas the last film was more him and Bryce and certainly the two little boys. I found another interesting note casting-wise in this film, whereas all previous Jurassic movies featured a couple of kids, siblings or relatives. This one really has one child, and it's actress Isabella Sermon. It's her first role. She's never done TV or movies before. She's fantastic in this, and her part grows throughout the film. So I thought it was interesting, you know, of course, that Chris having a little bit less work to do, but this is more of an ensemble piece.
And it also brought the introduction of a couple new characters. We have actor Justice Smith as the tech geek Franklin.
Who I love.
Yes.
He was like me in this movie. Like, you know, if I feel like his character was exactly how I would have reacted, which is so nice to see. Did you identify with him also?
Oh, definitely. Like, I would not. I would say, like, is that a T-Rex?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. All the time. Yeah. Everyone else is super cool. And he's like, why am I here?
Yeah. Same. And I also really love the paleo veterinarian, Zia, played by Daniela Pineda.
I love the two of them together. I feel like they could almost take, you know, the franchise off on their own. But it's great having Jeff Goldblum back.
Yes.
James Cromwell was a really nice addition. B.D. Wong, who is like the one, you know, consistent throughout this entire franchise, is there. And but yeah, absolutely. The new cast members really freshened up and brought some very, very needed levity and also heart to this.
Do you think, regarding the script of this film and the direction, could one not transcend the other? I felt like maybe they were playing tug of war and it couldn't quite reach that full potential, you know, because it hinted towards some of the original awe that Steven Spielberg's original film brought mm-hmm. to us. But I feel like it couldn't quite go there. And I don't know if that's because, okay, this is the fifth movie they're trying to do, and it's proven that they get people in the seats.
Right.
But what's, you know, at what price?
I think that what you're touching upon here is something very visceral, because one of the things that I missed in this movie that I was really yearning for was that extremely powerful and impactful John Williams theme music. And it's unforgettable and iconic. And, you know, usually you hear it right when you get to the island. And this time we get to the island that's, you know, decrepit. And so we don't hear it then, or we hear it just very subtly. And so it's almost underused, the theme music. We heard it maybe three times, and even in the end credits, it's not featured largely. So usually these films had those majestic, magical dinosaur moments, and there's that sweeping, you know, and the music sort of brings in some, heightens the emotion of it all. And so I think this did lack a little bit on that end, and I think it's tied to the music, or maybe it's just darker overall, so you're feeling some of that. Could that be it?
Perhaps, but I do feel like, although it gave nods to the original, mm-hmm. It couldn't quite get there, you know, and right. the music, either they gave a hint of the main theme or they maybe took a minor tone with it or, you know, maybe reflecting the darkness of it. But I feel like also the big climax of this film was not as big and sweeping. And that could do with the setting that was in, too. But right. I felt like, you know, the battles were somewhat predictable. You know, they have this massive Indoraptor, which mm-hmm. is this genetically modified crazy creature that is definitely scary. But ultimately, you still want the moment where the dinosaurs reign supreme. You know, ultimately, right. we're going there to see dinosaurs beat everyone else.
Even like when we saw, you know, the Velociraptors attack the T-Rex at the end of the first Jurassic World and then seeing that big sea creature, you know, thing. So the first Jurassic World had a very different climax. And you're right. I'd say that this climax is different and maybe smaller in a way, but maybe it is because of location. But I also think it's interesting we're at a very unique point in this franchise because it's rebooted as of Jurassic World with, you know, Chris and Bryce. But and then this is the sequel to that. So we're kind of going to see whether or not this does well and this is going to become a trilogy or if this is the end of the franchise. Will it be rebooted again someday? If that's the case, I certainly hope to see another one. This sets up a very interesting and potentially crazy, huge sequel if this one is going to have, you know, another one. But also, one thing that we missed, because you and I kind of bolted at the end of the film and didn't stay through the end of the credits.
Yeah, apparently there's an end scene.
There's a button.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we didn't get to see that. So if anyone does go out and see it, they should certainly stay for that after the credits moment.
Okay, that's a good thing to know, because I heard about it after the fact that we left. But that does touch on the question I was going to ask is, do they need a third act to properly either send this franchise off or just give us the kind of movie we're longing for that they're not quite getting to, like they're hinting at and building up to?
Well, that's just the thing is, like, I really hope this does well, because don't you think the way that this is set up, again, without ruining it for people and spoiling it, what would happen next? I think the wheels come off in such a big way to this story. I can't even imagine being the set designer, being the production designer for the next film in this franchise, because the implications are so huge that it would just be unbelievable. And I would love to see them try to conquer that.
Yeah, I think it did a good job at leaving it open-ended where, you know, it could go either direction if for some reason it doesn't do well enough to get a third installment. But I think you and I can agree that it probably will.
Yeah, it should.
Eventually. So overall, your thoughts on getting people to the theater to see this? Do you think it's one to see for the summer?
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite movies of the year, I think, because of how great the story is, how great the effects are, the chemistry between the cast. It sets up, you know, the next one so beautifully. And I love a PG-13 movie that plays almost like a rated R in tone. So this is a must-see for me.
All right, Ryan. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Film critic Ryan Jay is a nationally syndicated radio host, resident reviewer on Channel 4's The Morning Blend and Saturday News, and joins us as a film contributor on Lake Effect. For other recent film segments, you can head on over to WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then the latest episode of Ex Fabula when Lake Effect Weekend returns on 89.7 WUWM.
Two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
Ex Fabula Radio Time, once again on Lake Effect Weekend, on another beautiful June weekend. I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney is the co-founder of Milwaukee Ex Fabula. Every week we have stories for you based on a theme. And the theme this week is?
The theme this week is Never Say Never.
Never.
What did I just tell you?
Sorry.
I've read a couple stories today, a couple stories from our fantastic season 9, where we had a lot of fantastic partnerships all across Milwaukee. In today's stories, I brought one of them is a traveling memory, and the second one is the power of the human will and spirit. So let's start into our first story. This is our Never Say Never story from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel travel writer Chelsea Lewis. And this particular event partnership was partnered with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for a special curated storytelling event titled On the Road, And here is our Never Say Never on the Road story from Chelsea Lewis.
So a lot of my trips, especially for work, I travel alone, which usually doesn't make me too nervous, although after Mia's story, I don't know, maybe I should rethink that. It does make my mother very nervous, of course, because I'm a woman and she's a mom and she'll worry about me till I'm 80 years old. But traveling alone does have its advantages. And this summer I was up in Sparta, which is in that Driftless area of the state. And I was going to bike the Elroy Sparta Trail. And the Elroy Sparta Trail is kind of like the granddad of bike rail trails, rail trail bike trails in the state. And these are trails that were converted from old railroad lines. And this was the first one in the country that they did this to, and it kind of sparked this movement in Wisconsin and across the country. And what's extra cool about this trail is it goes through three old railroad tunnels, because it's a hilly part of the state and trains don't like hills, and so they just burrow through the hill instead of going over it. So I'm in Sparta, and I'm going to catch a shuttle kind of to the beginning of the trail, which is about 30 miles away in Elroy. And I'm a little early for the shuttle, and I'm just putzing around in the shop, and one of the employees comes over and talks to me, and it's a little bit older gentleman, and we're making small talk and talking about where he likes to bike in the state. And he's giving me tips on the trail, and he says, okay, yeah, the third tunnel, it's very wet and dark, and make sure you have your flashlight, of course, and walk your bike through, and then when you get out, look for Tunnel Tom. And I'm like, Tunnel Tom? And he's like, yeah, it's this guy. He's got this little shack outside that he, you know, gives out. And I kind of stopped listening because I'm like, yeah, a man with a shack on the side of a bike trail, I'm not stopping there. Yeah, like, I like to meet new people, especially as a journalist. I like to hear new stories, but I'm not stopping for a strange man on the side of a bike trail. So I say goodbye and thank you, and I get on my bike and start biking this beautiful trail, and it's a great ride. I think it was a sunny, beautiful day. I get to the third tunnel, and it's creepy, as he promised. And I get through to the other side, and I'm kind of taking some photos. And then I turn, and a man is approaching me. And it takes me a little bit. Oh, it's Hank from the bike shop who had told me about Tunnel Tom. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, he must have biked back to meet me, which is nice and a little creepy, too. And he comes over and asks me how my ride was. And then he says, yeah, you know, I can bike back with you. I'm like, okay, that'll actually be nice. And then he's like, and I can introduce you to Tunnel Tom. I said, oh, okay, great. Now there's two men and me. Perfect. So we walk up the trail, and there's kind of a clearing and a house and this long line of chairs and a gentleman sitting in the chairs and then this homemade shack with ice-cold water and ice cream. And Tunnel Tom kind of ambles over, and Hank introduces me, and before I know it, I have an ice cream sandwich in my hand and a water bottle, and I just bike 20 miles, so of course I'm eating them without even thinking. And turns out Tunnel Tom actually is a very interesting guy. He actually grew up right next to this trail. He lived there his entire life, and he lived there when it was a railroad line and trains still came through. So he told me some awesome stories about living along this railroad line, and one time how he was sitting in his dining room as a boy and his mom just screams, run, run! And being kids, they don't run, of course. They look out the window and there's a helicopter coming right for their house. They lived close to Fort McCoy and a helicopter was gonna crash. So they run out of the house. Thankfully, it just crashes on the railroad line, but now there's a train coming. So Tom and his brother run up to the tunnel and they flag down the conductor, and the conductor leans out the window and says, you know, boys, it's a federal crime to stop a train. And all of a sudden we're in a Western and Clint Eastwood is there. I don't know. But so Tom just had so many interesting stories like this. And I don't, if I had not been by myself, I probably wouldn't have met Hank in that bike shop. I definitely wouldn't have stopped for the ice cream shack on the side of the road. And I think that so often we're so obsessed with getting from point A to point B that we miss the Tunnel Toms in between. You got to jump and run. You got to hide, hide, hide. The old man is down the road. You got the voices speaking riddle. You got the eyes black as coal. You got a suitcase covered
And that was Chelsea Lewis's story. She writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Travel and Wisconsin Trail section.
Sounds like a perfect job for her as a travel writer. Mm-hmm. I can really relate to the fact what she said there at the end. People are so obsessed with getting to where they're going,
right. They
miss what's along the way. That's why I don't like to fly anywhere unless I really have to.
Oh, a lot of stuff happens on a flight if you keep your eyes open to that.
Well, I don't, I'm talking about you drive all the way
sure. There.
Yeah. You see everything between from where you are to where you're going. And that's part of the trip, man. Just to fly somewhere and you're there,
That's me snapping. I totally agree with you.
Okay, sounds good.
Now, life is happening when someone's not looking or
something like that, yes. Yeah. But I like to see everything along the way.
Yes. So that's a great way to live, for sure.
I'm with you, Chelsea.
So we're going to move it along to our next Never Say Never story. This story was told at our Story Slam-themed work. And it was in partnership with the Hispanic Professionals of Greater Milwaukee, the Hmong Young Professionals, Social K, the Working Lives Project, and the Wisconsin Humanities Council. A whole bunch of partners there. Let's listen to Serena Beecher's story.
My work story is about a place that unexpectedly launched my career. In 2003, following my high school graduation, I found out I was pregnant. My parents were in the middle of relocating to North Carolina, and growing up in Port Washington, a charming, judgmental little lake town, I hightailed it down south with my boyfriend. A few weeks later, my parents decided that if I was grown enough to have a baby, I should have my own apartment. So I moved, and I got a job. My first job out of high school was a waitress at the Texas Steakhouse. It was in Lumberton, North Carolina. Lumberton lives in infamy. It is the place where Michael Jordan's father was murdered. Per capita income is around $15,500. It's also notorious for an ongoing FBI investigation that put 16 sheriff's deputies and the former sheriff in prison. It's a drug hub halfway between Miami and New York. I left the comforts of Ozaukee County, where I was nicknamed Hillary Banks, for a place that was known by local anthropologists as the Lost Colony. I was 6'7", 8", and nearly 9 months pregnant, pulling double shifts at the Texas Steakhouse. I had a couple spend their entire dinner trying to convince me to give up my baby to them. My car broke down in the parking lot. A few days later, my boyfriend's car broke down too, in the parking lot. So they used to answer the phone. Hey, this is a Texas Steakhouse and Serena's used car lot. How can I help you? I could never refill the sweet tea drinks fast enough. And my life was it was pretty hard. I gave birth to my son on February 23rd, 2004, at Southeastern Regional Hospital. My boyfriend and I split up after about 6 months. He came back to Mequon. I continued waitressing, and I enrolled in community college. When I started school in my first week, everybody went around the room and said what they wanted to be. I always wanted to be a journalist. Teacher pulled me aside after class, and she said, Serena, you're a single mom. You'll never be a journalist. She said that I should maybe try healthcare or something like that. In 2006, I returned to Wisconsin, and I enrolled at MATC. I landed on the college newspaper, and I became the opinions editor, their editor-in-chief. Proudly, 2 years later, I graduated and I walked across the stage. A week later, I found out I didn't graduate. I had failed math. I was broke, I was tired, and I called my parents and said, I need to come home. I packed up my car with everything that I could fit, and me and my son moved back to North Carolina. A few weeks later, I took my stack of METC newspapers with full issues, and I went around to editors. I did not want to be a waitress. I wanted to be a reporter. I finally got a call from an editor who said, I want you to come see me. I came and saw him. I spread out the newspaper on his desk to show him my center feature, and he gave me a job. I became the crime reporter in Robeson County, the highest crime-ridden county in North Carolina, and it was in Lumberton, North Carolina. On the second day of my job, I interviewed Senator Elizabeth Dole at Southeastern Regional Hospital, where I had my son 4 years prior. 2 weeks into my new job, I got an email. It said, "Why haven't you signed up for your classes?" It was from Marquette University. When I had moved, they sent my acceptance package to my old address. So a year later, after filing 700 and something stories, working 18 hours a day, literally crying over my articles because my editor was ruthless, I returned to Wisconsin and I went to Marquette University, where I graduated with honors in 2012. Thank you. I have been a published writer for 11 years. My son is going into high school next year. Can't believe it. He showed me his chin hair this evening. But Lumberton taught me this. It taught me work ethic. It taught me to never give up. And it taught me that everybody has a story. And in the meantime, I'm working for a PR agency, and I'm plucking away at my novel, Blue Hydrangea, which is set in nowhere else but Lumberton, North Carolina. Never say never. Thank you.
And that was Serena Beecher's story told at our Work Story Slam.
A lot of us do all kinds of work before we find the job and the profession we really want to. I mean, I washed trucks for a while.
We'll talk about that later.
And here I am sitting at a radio console.
Yeah. So yes, Serena Beecher, congratulations to you. You know, we have a couple of things happening with Exfabula over the summertime. We have a very secret event that's coming up that we will divulge the information to you eventually. But we also have our season 10 themes that we need to start thinking about. And we are going to give the listening audience an opportunity to jump online in July and vote for their favorite themes, of which we will have our season 10 story slams.
I have a couple of ideas. I'm going to submit them at your website for Story Slam ideas.
Well, you better. You might want to email me.
You betcha I will.
Yeah. I believe that one of the themes will be trucks.
Well, maybe a theme of what the...
Yeah. That's not bad, actually.
All right. Anything you want to know, Exfabula, is at your website.
Exfabula.org.
And if you want to hear these stories again, share them with friends. It's at WUWM.com. We're here every weekend during Lake Effect Weekend, and we'll be back next week.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show for today. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, and be sure to tune into our weekday version of the show at 10 in the morning.
It is all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now. All Things Considered is next. It's 4 o'clock.